Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Toss another shrimp on the barbie. It's time for another flat chat. And as the latest issue of GP Racing magazine hits the shelves, we're looking forward to the first Australian Grand Prix in 3 years. And joining us from the scene, almost, is our reporter who will be actually travelling to Melbourne, a slightly short hop. G'day, yeah. Mark Gallagher.
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement here in Australia. And you're right, I'm nipping over from the scene of the original Australian Grand Prix back in the 80s from Adelaide over to Melbourne, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be great. I'm genuinely looking forward to catching up with a few familiar faces, but also seeing the 2022 breed of car on the track and having a look at what Formula One post-COVID, well, kind of, we say it's post-COVID, basically COVID's still going, but we're vaccinated against it so as much as we can be. So here in Australia, everything's kind of opened up again, but there is a lot of enthusiasm for the return of Formula One after that 3-year hiatus. So no doubt we'll talk about it a little bit during the podcast.
I think 8 years since I last attended the Australian Grand Prix, first race of the hybrid era. I know, Ben, yes. Well, time to introduce our second guest. He's drawing breath in fear and loathing and horror at the thought of one of his colleagues not having attended the Australian Grand Prix for 8 years, is GP Racing editor Ben Anderson.
Hello. Yes. Mark, do you think your friends in Adelaide are expecting you to return with the Grand Prix to them?
From everything I hear, Melbourne is a shoe-in for the future. I think Adelaide misses the Grand Prix. It's quite something, you know, when you go out for a drink or dinner here with some friends. All these years later, everyone remembers the Adelaide Grand Prix with great fondness. And, I mean, I think the South Australians have just about gotten over the Victorian government nicking the Grand Prix. But what's very clear is that there's an awareness that Formula One's on a high at the moment. And across Australia, there's lots of cities that are interested in staging Australian Grand Prix in the future. And we've seen rumours about Sydney, what they might do. So, yeah, it's kind of topical. The big news here in Adelaide is that the Adelaide 500 is coming back. And that used to be the Clipsal 500 when they sponsored it. So Adelaide lost its V8 supercars race, and that's definitely coming back, and it's coming back this year. So there's been a change of government. The new government have announced that, and that's pretty well the Adelaide Grand Prix track of old. I mean, there's a few changes, but essentially it's in the parklands and massive event. I think the last time I looked, the Adelaide 500 over the weekend attracted something like 335,000 spectators. So it's a massive event, and South Australians love their racing. So it's going to be big.
My overriding memory of going to Adelaide to watch a race, which was the Race of 1,000 Years American Le Mans Series race, was that...
God, that's a long time to be watching a race, Codders.
it took longer than that to get through security, because Adelaide Airport didn't get... the impression I got was that Adelaide Airport didn't receive many international flights. So the customs officers were very zealous. I came within inches of getting a full cavity search because we were also the bloke didn't like the look of me. I could tell as I was in queuing for the passports, you could see the customs guys standing hands on hips, glaring at people who they thought were hardened criminals, because I saw them looking at us and then I saw him looking at me. And so I kind of looked away thinking, oh, this is a bit weird. And that was the point where he realized I was a criminal trying to smuggle something into Australia.
He was determined
to find out what.
You clearly had dressed like a drug mule. And
it was the way I walked, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it's also the fact that you were eyeballing the security people the whole time, by the sounds of it, which isn't a really good strategy for getting
with a nervous disposition, because I would have said that never, ever, ever have I thought that Stuart Codlin looked like a hardened criminal. what were you wearing and what scowl were you wearing on your face?
Well, here's the thing, because it was the year 2000 and no one wore jeans, because the All Saints popular beat combo had declared them ungood, I was wearing combat pants, which of course had pockets all over the place. The bloke actually said, I bet you got some Ecky tablets in there. Because, of course, all Australians talk with that rising inflection, don't they? As if every half sentence is a question. I'm only joking. But
I'm not surprised you haven't been here for 8 years. I'm not sure they'd allow you back in.
Yes,
they would have imprisoned you for 1,000 years, I think, with that kind of impression.
It's when they ask you if you've got a criminal record and you say, well, I did buy Karma Drone by Pop Will Eat Itself. Okay, returning to the subject, I did have the trophies that were to be awarded to the winning drivers, or some sort of readers' awards, which were sort of glass cups with on a little wooden plinth. They were designed to be easily transportable, wrapped in my underwear and sorted clothes to avoid them smashing. So, of course, when they did a special X-ray on my suitcase, the bloke came bustling up to his chief, going, "Yeah, he's got something organic in there." I had to explain these trophies. He was so disappointed that it wasn't 20 kilograms of cocaine and it was actually three rather unimpressive looking cut glass plinthy things on top of a wooden disc. And then we saw him on the way out and he goes, "I hope you gave away those trophies. If I look inside your bags, you better not still have them." I don't know why. His accent seems to have migrated, doesn't it? He no longer sounds like an Adelaide resident.
Getting closer to Alan Bennett with every sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Shall we move on? Because we've already stretched our listeners' patience with this nonsense. On the cover of GP Racing this month, we have, an exclusive interview with Fernando Alonso. Been a long while coming. We first lodged the request in November. Was it October, Ben? I can't remember. We've been chivvying.
You tell me, Connors. I can't remember. 1,000 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, it was 1,000 years since we lodged. We actually lodged the request for this interview before he made his debut in Melbourne in 2000. Anyhow, it's been worth the wait. Fernando, one of F1's great characters, one of the fastest drivers on the grid still, despite being now nearly 40, so practically your granddad. And if you disagree with that, Andrew Benson will put a brick through your window because he knows
not nearly 40, he's in his 40s already.
Is he? I thought he was still 39.
Oh, well, you see, fresh-faced.
Do you know, it's because everything we thought was a year ago is actually 3 years ago.
Maybe in your Thousand Lakes TARDIS world. But in the real world over here, Fernando Alonso is in his 40s.
Okay, well, Fernando Alonso in his 40s.
He's replaced Kimi Raikkonen as F1's elder statesman.
His grandee. Yep, without wishing to inflame sentiments a lot quicker. There's some one-star reviews incoming right now.
Maybe it's fair to say slightly more determined for the same age.
Yes, much more determined. And we saw that a couple of weeks ago in the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, where there was a fantastic ding-dong with his young teammate Esteban Ocon in the opening laps. Arguably a little bit destructive to the team's hopes. And certainly Esteban went backwards after he was grudgingly gave up the chase, was instructed to stop contesting it. So, yeah, interesting. Fernando still got it.
Yeah, driving quite well. And also quite unfortunate not to have had points from the first two races either, which I think he was lamenting after events of Jeddah. Because Alpine have had quite a decent start. I mean, it's not obviously where they want to be, where they plan to be, or where Alonso signed up to be when he came back. But they don't seem to have gone backwards. And I was a little bit concerned that, you know, when you heard Laurent Rossi talking about, new powerful engine and I want performance over reliability, I don't care. It was all sounding a bit McLaren Honda circa 2015, and we all know what kind of unmitigated disaster that was for Fernando. And I had flashbacks on his behalf. But it does seem from the first couple of races that Alpine are in a decent position. They haven't certainly haven't lost any ground in the midfield. So hopefully they've got a pretty solid base to build on and they can start progressing as things close up. And of course, they need to do it quite quickly because, as Alonso says in the interview, he's not going to be around forever and probably not that much longer. So if he is going to make the most of this opportunity, it needs to come quick.
He talks about reaching 400 Grand Prix in his career. So, you know, he needs to keep going for this year plus, well, I was going to say at least a couple more. The way Stefano Domenicali is going with the championship, that's probably just one more year. when the 45 race, 23 championship is announced. But anyway, couple more years. But, well, the thing I found interesting about the feature was Alonso opened up about, you know, his approach to F1 now, despite this long passage of time. He makes a number of very good points about differences, for example, between himself and Michael Schumacher. When Michael stepped away from Formula One for a while, in that Fernando kept on racing. He's kept himself really active and busy, you know, IndyCar racing and sports car racing and, you know, Dakar and all the rest of it. So, you know, he's kept on it. He's kept practiced at being as competitive as he can be. He's clearly relishing some aspects of being at Alpine. I think he's realistic enough to know that, you know, the team doesn't have a championship-winning car yet and probably won't do during his tenure there, but he doesn't mind the fact that they're trying to build towards that. And, you know, considering that he's being diplomatic about some of the questions that are put to him, I found it interesting that he acknowledges that change is not always a good thing, and the team has been through yet another series of management changes, which so there's been trouble.
It's none of the people who hired him, isn't it? That's the
trouble
interesting
at the
thing.
Top, like, yeah.
When he top, signed yeah. the deal, and yeah. he it was during 2020, wasn't it? I think, and he yeah. came back to the paddock in Renault t-shirts. So the branding yeah. was completely different. I think Cyril Abitbol yeah. was the guy that did the deal.
Yeah.
And all of those people, it's like a new broom, isn't it? So it's not the, yeah. really quite, obviously in fundamentals, it's the same team, but a lot of the people aren't the people that Alonso dealt yeah. with when he was planning the comeback. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, he talks about that, you know, Cyril and then Marcin Butkowski is gone and Alain Prost. I think Oleg makes the point that he didn't just leave. He slammed the door on his way out. He wasn't very,
yes.
he wasn't very yeah. happy to leave. So there's been a lot of change there. But going back to the points you guys were making earlier on, I mean, Fernando's been driving well. He's pushing hard. He clearly still loves the cut and thrust of racing. And whether it's cut and thrust of racing for you know, a handful of points or something a bit better, he still gets a big kick out of it. And in that respect, I think we should be happy that he has the approach that he has, because I think we all felt that Kimi got quite tired of it all towards the end, and I think we all got a little bit tired of Kimi towards the end, quite frankly.
Some people will never tire of Kimi.
They wanted him
to carry on racing until he was old as the Queen Mum.
We all appreciate what Kimi brought to the sport, but towards the end, you know, the sport's really evolved, and Kimi's, I mean, even since retiring, Kimi's admitted, you know, he doesn't really know why he had such a big fan following. He wasn't putting that much effort into it, you know. So he was a kind of this, it was a kind of counterculture, wasn't it? Like he didn't give a yeah. stuff, and yet people seem to think that was cool. Well, clearly Fernando gives a stuff about giving it everything and trying to be successful. And I have to say that last year when you saw that unexpected victory for Ocon in Hungary, you know, Fernando did the most extraordinary rear gunner role in that race and used all of his experience and speed and wiles to help the team to achieve his success. So I think it's fair to say when you read this feature, it underlines the fact that he's enjoying this opportunity to come back into Formula One with Alpine, with the team that he won the championships for all those years ago. And he's really pushing hard to get something out of it. So, you know, on the right day, you could imagine Fernando once again being on a podium if things fell his way, and he'll take the opportunities when they come there. And I have to say, I'm a great believer in relishing when you have these talents at the end of their career, because the day's going to come when they'll be gone to us. And I mean, I quite enjoyed seeing Michael, even though he was struggling a bit at Mercedes. It was still good to turn up at a race and see Michael Schumacher still racing there. And yeah, okay, he wasn't sticking it on pole and dominating the race or even beating his teammate, but you still knew you were enjoying the tail end of someone's career. With Fernando, there's more impetus at this stage in his life. He seems to be, I mean, he waxes lyrical about the fact that, you know, he's a better, more comprehensive driver today than he was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. I don't think he would be innately as perhaps as quick over a single lap as he would have been back then. But then that's not to say that he wouldn't put together a good race. He can still put together a good race. And at the end of the day, that's probably more important to Alpine at the moment than anything else, just his ability to bring the car home and to get it home in as good a position as possible. And I think from that last race, that, you know, the second round of this year's championship, and we saw the way Ocon was battling him, you know, I think actually Alonso's got a slightly bigger view of the contribution to the team sometimes than his teammate. And so he's contributing terrifically. And the question really remains what happens with Alpine over the balance of these regulations, because as I've written about in my column not so long ago, I think there's a question mark over what Alpine does on the far side of 2025, particularly if, as is rumored, Porsche and Audi have come into Formula One. You know, will Alpine ever realistically have a chance to win the championship? And if they don't, I'd question what the point is.
I think Alonso will be gone by then, though, won't he? I think in the future, he's said four. I think he's put 4 years on as a his own limit.
It's not going to happen.
So
that's not going to happen.
You know, I think he includes the first year in that. So this is year two. So I can see him doing 23 and 24 if they want to extend the contract, because obviously he's out of contract after this year as well. So
yeah,
it's sort of, there's quite a lot of moving parts there. But yeah, I couldn't, by the time the new engine regs come in, I think he'll be gone. I think he'd have hung his helmet up, or someone would have hung it up for him. He does seem to have got the second wind. I found that aspect of the feature quite interesting as well, that he's taken the break, not the break from racing. Obviously, he sharpened himself up by doing some different forms. But he also talks about how he realised there were bits of F1 that he used to think were pointless nonsense that actually are quite important to the fan base. He gives the example of like the national anthem before the race on the grid and having to attend that. But I'm sure there are many others. He seems to see Formula One in a slightly different light now. Being out of it has made him appreciate his time in it more. And he seems to have come back. Obviously, the determination and the ability and the hunger is still there, which it needs to be. And the way he smashed his helmet with his own hands when he retired in Jeddah, I thought was a stark contrast to the way Kimi Raikkonen would react when he didn't finish a race in the latter part of his career.
He'd be already on the phone, early flight.
Completely nonplussed. You know, he's also quite relaxed, I think. The Fernando came across in that interview much more relaxed than the Fernando that we knew from the end of his Ferrari career or his early McLaren career. You know, he was far more serious, I found, in those days. Almost like there was a weight on him of expectation and a huge frustration that it wasn't being met, usually through no fault of his own, whereas he seems to be a bit more philosophical now. And maybe that's just because he knows that he's closer to the end than the beginning, so he's just going to try and make the most of it while he can. You know, he can get paid quite well to race in Formula One. He talks about other series not doing so well during the pandemic. So I think he's kind of made peace with what's happened in the past, and he's prepared to kind of do his best for as long as he's allowed to.
You gain a lot of perspective in that gap between GP Racing requesting an interview and actually getting it, don't you? Whether it's 1,000 years or 6 months. On a separate but related Alpine, potato, potato note, we also have an exclusive with the best driver not on the grid at the moment, also part of that Alpine ecosystem, but birthless. And there's a particular resonance here as we speak in the days before the Australian Grand Prix. If you've downloaded it straight away, fingers on the buzzers, you'll be listening to this before the Australian Grand Prix, because Oscar Piastri is Australian, managed by Mark Webber, and yet spending a year on the sidelines, maybe even longer than that. What do we make of that? It's an interesting interview. He seems to be kind of at peace with it in as much as he can be. It's difficult, isn't it? He's kind of taken a lot of people by surprise, hasn't he? I think the people who sponsored his early career or supported his early career, particularly even Alpine, didn't actually see this F2 championship coming as early as it has done.
No, and they'll be made up, won't they? Because they've saved themselves a load of cash by the fact that he's managed to win it in one season instead of two. And probably they didn't bank on him winning Formula 3 so quickly either. So they're probably 2 years up on their business plan. Yeah. They're feeling quite pleased with themselves. But I think at the same time, it shows you that although Formula 1 is moving in a good direction and the teams are obviously a lot healthier and the new Concorde Agreement has helped with that, and they're adding new races and, you know, the fan base is growing, etc., there's still a few situations that don't sit quite so well in terms of, you know, are the best, brightest talents still breaking through when they should? And, you know, looking at the current grid, as strong as it is, I think there's probably at least three drivers, and you could make an argument for another three that he should be in ahead of based on what he's done. Latifi, Zhao, who obviously, you know, beat him to the Alfa Romeo seat. There was talk of Piastri getting some kind of deal there before his reserve role for this year. You could argue Stroll, who's in there because of his dad financing that team. Maybe even people like Mick Schumacher, Tsunoda, Albon, guys who are on driver schemes, rival ones, but haven't really performed that well or consistently on them. Their paymasters are persevering for other reasons. Piastri seems to have been more impressive at the lower levels than those guys have. Certainly, he's performed at a similar level. Okay, the opposition is a relative question, but, you know, it's mentioned in the feature the likes of Charles Leclerc and George Russell. These are guys who are now at top teams and considered generational talents. Like, you'd have to consider on an achievement basis, Piastri's knocking on that door and yet he can't get on the grid. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure Formula One's quite managed to deal with that aspect as much as the rest of it seems to be going so superbly in the right direction.
The thing that really struck me about the feature was the calmness. You know, he's very calm about where he's at because he's done everything that was expected of him. He's got this formidable track record, you know, ran a Euro Cup, Formula 3, Formula 2. What else can I do? And I think this structural issue that we're in a little bit of a transitional period in Formula One where, to be blunt, you still have pay drivers and yet the sport is on a growth spurt. And if that growth spurt achieves its its potential, if Williams have lots of sponsorship, if Alfa Romeo get more sponsorship, the requirement for pay drivers will start to diminish. Williams are very nice about Latifi, but the reality is if they had a full budget coming from major sponsors, they wouldn't probably have Latifi in the team. And I think Jos Capito would be out there looking for the best possible talent to stick in that car to try and move them up the Constructors' Championship. So as the economic model of Formula One changes in this post-Concorde Agreement, post-budget cap, sponsorship surge, Netflix effect era that we have in Formula One, unless the commercial teams are doing a rubbish job, every team on the grid should start to build their revenue and profitability up, and it should start to move into a different era. And that has to be what Liberty would hope for. My view is that, you know, we are probably, there's a little bit of a lag, and that lag is probably 2 years. So you're kind of, the driver market is probably lagging 2 years behind the commercial market shift. So the commercial market has really grown massively over the last year. We've got this post-COVID era for Formula One. So you would realistically expect by 23, 24, that the absolute necessity to take a pay driver should start to wane. I think the other thing is that, putting a lot into this sort of answer, but I think there's also the fact that whilst everyone's complaining about the championship, well, not everyone, a lot of people are complaining about the championship getting bigger, the whole point of the championship coming bigger is that the central revenue of Formula One and the profitability of Formula One increases, which means that the prize money is bigger. So the growth that Stefano Domenicali is trying to drive in the championship ultimately cascades down to helping all the teams. So there is a the calmness that Piastri has is probably well-founded because he certainly has to wait a year. He might have to wait 2 years, which would be really a shame. But clearly he's ready to step in. And when the opportunity arises, he's got the talent to be there and to make the most of the opportunity. I mean, it's really interesting we've come on to talking about him straight after Fernando Alonso because the reality is that if Luca Di Meo and Laurent Rossi at Alpine have exactly the conversation that you guys have had, they go, is he 39 or is he, oh gosh, he's in his 40s now. You know, they may well just take the view, look, we can't wait until Fernando Alonso's career starts to tail off. We've got maybe 3 years left in our program where we have to deliver. And perhaps Piastri's the guy, he's the future. And they have to look down the grid and say, look at Charles Leclerc, look at Max Verstappen, look at George Russell, and say, we've got to get the young Lando Norris, yeah. You've got to get the young guns in and give them the opportunity to deliver. So, I mean, what's so impressive about that interview with Piastri for me is that he's done exactly what you want every young driver to do. You're given an opportunity, you take it by the scruff of the neck, you go out and you win the championship, and you do it at your first attempt. None of this, oh, I need a year to learn. I mean, just go out and deliver. And that's really impressive. And the top guys tend to be like that. They just get on and they deliver the opportunity. They deliver when they're given the opportunity. So it is a shame that he's treading water. One other thing really to talk about is we know that there are, you know, we've had Andretti trying to come into Formula One. There's been a lot of talk. Is there going to be an 11th team, the 12th team? Many people taking the view that an 11th or 12th team will obviously open the door to drivers like Piastri getting an opportunity. I just don't see that happening. And again, I don't see it happening because Formula One's decision-making in recent years has really strengthened the existing franchises. Mm-hmm. And in strengthening existing franchises, teams like Williams will want to move to a model where instead of having a pay driver and a ringer, you have two really talented people going for it and delivering the success that you're looking for. So I think just everyone needs to be a little bit patient, and those 10 teams will ultimately end up with, hopefully, you know, the quickest drivers in the world. You've got a couple of outliers like Lance Stroll, who is clearly competent, but perhaps no more than that. Has he got the ability to win the world championship? We haven't seen that indication that it's there, even if his father believes that he has. And so there's lots of question marks that are still out there about structural things like that. But ultimately for Piastri, he's done everything he could have been expected to deliver. And in Mark Webber, he cannot hope to have a better person manage him from a networking perspective, because Mark knows everyone in the paddock. And if anyone is going to convince a team to put Oscar in the car and go for it, it'll be Mark. So just a bit of patience, and I'm sure the opportunity will arise. And I just hope for his sake it arises in a competitive team, because if he's given a halfway competitive car, I think he'll be another great talent to be able to enjoy at the top of Formula One.
There's also an argument to say that gently nudging the pay drivers and ringers, etc., towards the off-ramp has never been more important in Formula One, because the show has become quite all-consuming. We'd live in a post-Ecclestone era, but Bernie always used to describe drivers who were quick-ish but weren't sexy in terms of sponsorship and weren't sexy in terms of the show and opening up Formula One to new markets. He rather unkindly described them as Brundle Schmundle. And with no disrespect to our learned colleague and Ed, very fast, very quick racing driver and also excellent commentator, Martin. It's a shame that his surname rhymed with such a dismissive term that Bernie Ecclestone could attach it to. But there are drivers who do not contribute anything to the box office appeal, even with their driving. And you have to say, Nicholas Latifi, nice bloke, lovely bloke to speak to, quick-ish, but you would ideally want to slot someone who was quicker and a little bit more kind of star quality. You know, they don't just occupy a seat. They sort of almost act as an enthusiasm vacuum for the audience. You don't imagine the Netflix people troubling themselves terribly with what he or Alex Albon do.
They did a special on Mazepin, though, didn't they?
Yeah, that's because he was a bit of a tosser. So, you know, and there you see, you know, you can be a very, very mediocre Formula One driver and still be interesting, you know, if, for instance, you have certain unreconstructed behaviours in your past. Maybe, you know, if he'd turned up to races in a stretched limo with a load of call girls in the back, that would have generated a lot of attention on Netflix. Obviously, you know, it would have been quite polarising. But once again, it doesn't harm F1's box office at all to have personalities front and centre, does it, as well as great drivers. Maybe I'm just being needlessly controversialist.
Well, sometimes it's a bit awkward, isn't it? Because if you take Zhao Guan Yu, who, you know, there are drivers. We should say also, we add the caveat that we are talking about a high calibre of drivers. You know, people like Lance Stroll and Zhao, who've been mentioned as guys that maybe don't quite cut it compared to some others. They're still incredibly good drivers who've been very successful at the lower levels and could be successful in other categories. But it's whether they belong on the elite grid and justify that whichever place they have on it. And we know with Zhao, he shouldn't really be ahead of Piastri in the queue. I think that's fair to say. No one would really argue that based on his track record and assessment of generally how impressive he's been over the years. But he opens up that Chinese market, doesn't he? So there are some drivers who they will contribute to the box office, whether or not they're a fantastic personality. I mean, you know, Yuki Tsunoda is, by all accounts, quite an interesting and funny kid, quite a good personality to have in Formula One, but has his driving so far justified his continued place at AlphaTauri? Probably not. And if Red Bull were a little bit healthier in the driver scheme stakes, he probably would have gone. I mean, even he was surprised he got his contract extended last year. So, I mean, at least he had the self-awareness to recognise that he wasn't doing a particularly good job. But sometimes the line is a bit blurred. You know, Zhao might pull his weight more in the fact that he just draws so many more eyes onto the Chinese Grand Prix when Formula One finally does return there. And therefore, he justifies his place even if the driving isn't quite up to the scratch of some others. Maybe there's no ideal solution. I mean, you know, Sergio Perez is obviously now he's a Grand Prix winner and he's at a top team, but I mean, he was forever lumbered with the pay driver tag because of his Mexican portfolio of sponsors. And of course, now there's a Mexican Grand Prix again and it's massively popular. And a lot of that is driven through him. So does he justify his place on the grid because of these other aspects, as well as being obviously a very decent driver? Or actually, should he be getting out of the way and should there just be other people in those seats, regardless of all these other considerations? I'm not sure. It's a difficult debate. But certainly in the case of Piastri, you feel like a guy who's swept through the junior categories and won at an incredible rate and truncated his learning so much would deserve some kind of race seat over and above some of these guys who it's difficult to see what they add beyond the bottom line in the team's coffers.
I mean, you make a very good point there about the driver, the pay drivers or the drivers who are brought into, you know, there's another commercial reason because there's a strategic relationship with a particular sponsor or an engine manufacturer or whatever. And we can all tell from the dynamic, even in the team, that they are the kind of, oh yes, and we've got this other driver. You know, it's kind of you can almost tell the PR people are like PR staff are very often right. Well, so do you want to talk with driver A? And you go, well, yes, we do. And they say, well, actually, today we'd also like you to speak to driver B. And you think, no, I don't want to speak to him actually, because you know, what are we going to learn? You know, and you can tell they're kind of trying to keep everyone happy. And it's a shame. And, you know, you get it. I mean, when you watch the Netflix Drive to Survive series and you see the emphasis on you know, certain team principals, certain drivers, you know, who's box office. And then periodically they'll bring someone in who's, you know, a lesser famous team principal or a lesser famous driver. And you feel slightly sorry for them, because the fact is that, you know, to be blunt, some of these people are making up the numbers, and it's and literally making up the financial numbers. And you have to wonder what they themselves think from time to time, because they must be aware of the coverage and the impact that they're having in the sport. And I can't think of anything more disillusioning than sensing that you're kind of playing second fiddle to your teammate constantly, and that you're somehow just, again, you're just treading water. What are you actually taking away from it? And again, you know, I don't want to pick on the Strolls, but when I look at the Stroll family, I reflect on the fact that, you know, Lawrence Stroll has done an amazing job as an investor to save that team, buy that team, build that team, invest in it, build a factory. What a fantastic legacy he is potentially building with Aston Martin in Formula One. And the Lance Stroll element to that strategy, I also get it. I mean, which father isn't proud of their child and want to help them and move them on? But, you know, you also think, well, at some point you have to deliver, and this is not a game. This is deadly serious business. You want to have the best possible drivers in both your cars at all times. And if you're serious about your stated goals, I mean, you mustn't compromise on any area at all. And, you know, we're looking at Formula One at the moment. You know, you see Ferrari have come into the season strongly. Red Bull are right there. Mercedes have had a, you know, obviously they've got some issues that you're going to try and overcome. You look at the disappointments at the start of the season with Williams have slipped back, with, you know, McLaren after a fantastic season last year, you know, there seems to be a struggle at the beginning of this year. Aston Martin after a difficult year last year. You look at all of these, it's so difficult down there. Why compromise in any area? And when there's a driver like Oscar Piastri out there, really and truthfully, someone should be snapping them up and saying, we've got to have this guy in our car, because this represents the future. And instead of that, there's all these other kind of slightly compromising factors influencing decision making over driver lineup. You know, we're in a transitional phase. Oh, you know, we don't quite have the budget, so therefore we've got to have this pay driver. And so all of that adds up to an excuse as to why you're not competitive. You've got to get rid of that and get every aspect of your team aligned. You know, get the commercials right. Don't be relying on a pay driver. Make sure that you have the very best talent. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, again, you know, the three of us know particularly, once you have those off-the-record conversations with mechanics, with engineers, and even sometimes with team principals, they will admit to you, you know, we're compromised on half of our team this year. And you think, well, how can that possibly be allowed to continue? If you all know fundamentally that you're compromised, that's something that you really ought to change, because, you know, this is a split-second sport, and a tenth here and a tenth there does actually make a bloody big difference over time. So it's interesting to once again be reflecting on the way in which the driver market funnels into Formula One, and sometimes that funnel becomes a block, which is in the case of Piastri. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. Hopefully 2023, we'll see something interesting emerge for him.
You touched on the changing competitive picture up and down the grid, and certainly Williams maybe not hitting the heights we'd kind of expected, or not making the progress that expected. McLaren engaging reverse gear somewhat. We have taken a look at some of the new tech up and down the grid in this issue. To my mind, one of the great things of a new technical era is none of the teams have had an opportunity to look at one another's homework. So lots of different solutions to the new rules, some obviously more successful than others. And who would have thought it would be Ferrari versus Red Bull at the beginning of 2022? And the Mercedes car looks very interesting, fascinating, bold, above a certain speed, starts to imitate a pogo stick. What do we think about the 2022 season so far?
Yeah, it's been interesting, isn't it? I mean, so can I just say, great feature, Stuart.
It was. It was very good. Yeah, very good.
Really, really good. I mean, to listeners, you know, what we've got there in that feature is a really good summation of the complexity and the interconnectedness of the designs on these cars. You know, one element feeds off the other, you know, from the front wing all the way back to the diffuser, the underbody, the way in which to get the air sealed properly underneath these cars, the way in which, you know, floors are having to be used in really, I mean, the complexity and the sophistication of that goes into these designs is something to behold. And it's another reason I'm so looking forward to being in Melbourne and going in, having a look at the cars up close, because the last time I was actually in a garage and had a good poke around a car was in 2019. This is all because of COVID restrictions. Mm-hmm. So the last time I was able to go in a garage and have a good look at a car with its clothes off, I was actually with Lewis at Mercedes, and I just couldn't believe
it. You were poking around inside that Mercedes. Yeah. I don't know how you managed to do that
around in my car, man.
I was great. It's supposed to have friends in high places, and there are actually a surprising number of people at Mercedes who are former Jordan people. So I got invited in to have a good look. And it was a while since I'd looked at the detail. And I mean, it's almost organic nature of the designs in these cars, the way everything is integrated together is just
phenomenal, aren't they? They are phenomenal to look at, Formula One cars.
They absolutely work.
They're works of art, I would say.
They are complete works of art. It is a shame that most of the time, most fans and followers of the sport get to see the cars only with their bodywork on. And you know, they come out of the garage, down the pit lane, out onto the racetrack, and you don't get to see the detail that goes into them, and they put screens up to stop people poking around. When you see a naked F1 car today and you go up and you see the way in which the hydraulics and the electronics and the electrics and the cooling system and the fuel system and everything has been integrated to within, you know, to millimeter perfection, it is so extraordinary. And in this, you know, in the feature on the design of this year's car and the way the regulations have been interpreted by the teams, again, looking at how a team like Red Bull takes the floor and effectively uses the floor to create what barge boards used to do, you know, to create the way in which that every element feeds through so that you're getting the required output. And then the impact that those aerodynamics have on the cooling systems and the way in which, you know, all of those elements have to be integrated. And then the brilliant thing is to look at the different philosophies, you know, from team to team across the grid. You know, certain teams doing certain treatments of the front nose cone, nose design, wing mounting, then the T-tray, double tray, T-tray, the floor sections, the widths of the floor. The fact that a team like Red Bull aren't even using the maximum width of the floor, they've got other considerations. They want to get that flow and the sealing effect on the underbody to maximum effect. And then, as you say, Cotters, the way Mercedes have, you know, they come up with a risky, innovative approach to the design of this car is one that a design which, because it's had this unintended consequence of really quite severe porpoising, and they now need to fix that. But, you know, you reverse up a number of months and you think they've obviously sat down in Brackley and gone, right, this is the way to go. This is the solution that's going to give us the optimal performance. But it's led to this other issue arising. And it's therefore understandable why Toto Wolff looks at the results of the first couple of races and says, this is completely unacceptable. So that very, very talented group of people have come up with that philosophy and that design concept and that some kind of radical changes to design philosophy. How can we almost effectively get rid of the side pods as we understand them and yet have come up against this fundamental problem, which they now have to solve in the heat of battle in the season? So the intricacies are just extraordinary. And I think the great thing about this feature is it goes some way to explaining to the F1 fan and the layperson just how complex this entire process is. And never mind the minuscule detail that all the people in the teams are having to deal with. So it's excellent, really, really interesting.
Phew. I mean, it's very difficult to write these features because there is kind of a culture in Formula One, certainly the media, of I've slightly mocked it in a column I wrote a few months ago, of people who sort of self-appointed experts who like to kind of grandstand and point at various bits of the car and say that makes this do that and whatever, which to an extent it does, but there's no one thing you can change on an F1 car to find half a second. There's no magic bullet. And of course, when you're doing a magazine, you have an art department who want to have pictures, and they actually want to have arrows pointing at things and saying this does that. So there's always a sort of a compromise you have to find. But yeah, it is amazing that, you know, these teams are only learning about the performance of the cars properly as they hit the track. So there's all sorts of questions coming about, and they are questioning the various philosophical directions they've taken. And Mercedes, you know, they might actually be they might be sitting on a brilliant concept. It's just that there is a kind of a roadblock that is preventing them from actually accessing that latent performance. So how they get around that is, well, we will see in the coming months.
It's interesting that you used the word magic bullet or silver bullet, because that's a phrase that Toto Wolff has used repeatedly in recent years when discussing his team's approach to Formula One and how it's iterative and there is no such thing. It's, you know, amalgamation, sum of all these tiny, small parts and little bits of time that add up to make you the quickest. And then you have this new Mercedes that's broken cover under this, you know, massive regulation shift, what, the biggest one in 40 years, Adrian Newey said. This is the time at which the cars will look the most different to each other. No one's been able to see anyone else's homework yet until you're up and running. So this is why we wanted to do this feature, because it's probably the most interesting time for Formula One visually until everyone starts to work out what each other's done and the grid begins to move in similar directions. And the Mercedes looks like one of the most different cars to the others. It's like they've gone for two or three silver bullets, even though their whole culture is not meant to be about that. And it's not worked. Yes, the potential might be in the car and the simulations might have said, you know, this is the fastest way to go. And they might be able to get to a point where they can unlock it. But certainly they're nowhere near unlocking it now. If they can unlock it, will they be able to do it consistently? We've seen so many times in the past, you know, a car that in theory can do the quickest lap, but the driver can only access the performance in half the corners or a quarter of the corners, and it turns out to be a dog. And it reminds me a little bit of, it's not, you know, completely analogous, but McLaren in 2012, they won the final race of the season with Jenson Button in Brazil. They'd evolved that car to be one of the quickest. Okay, reliability let them down and obviously led to Lewis Hamilton leaving the team, and he didn't win the championship, but he was in contention and McLaren were doing a good job, and they looked like they could be in quite good shape for the 2013 season, last year of the V8 era. And they went for a radical new design to try and get ahead of Red Bull and Ferrari in the championship, and they had a terrible season. Arguably, they've never recovered. Certainly, it took them, you know, another 10 years to win a race. So it's so easy to be in a good position and then suddenly throw it away by being too clever. It just feels a little bit similar. It's like Mercedes had everything working so well. And we don't know everything that's gone on behind the scenes, but there has been a lot of change at the team as well, as rules being thrown at them, etc. And it just seems like they've overreached. When your car doesn't look like everyone else's and it's not quick, then that's a really bad sign, I think. you want to be leading the way by quite a distance if you've got a really innovative, different car, hoping that everyone else is going to struggle to copy you. But it looks to me like the reverse has happened. And actually, you know, it's not a disaster. They're not, you know, miles off the pace, but they're certainly miles off where they should be and where they want to be. And it feels like they're going to have to evolve in the direction of Ferrari and Red Bull and others, rather than those people coming to them. And that's a really bad situation to be in when you're such a successful team. And I don't know, will they be able to react quickly enough and do it? You know, is it too complicated for them to unpick some of these elements?
I guess that's what we'll find out.
Especially with the budget cap environment.
So well, exactly,
it's going to take a while to revert back, as one of our colleagues would once have written.
It's always been the case recently, as they've tightened, you know, aerodynamic rules and testing restrictions, that you have to pick your path and know that what you're testing is going to bear fruit when you add it to the car. It's, you know, even before the budget cap came in, Mercedes couldn't just throw money at every single idea that anybody ever had and just wait to see which ones look good or come good. But there's more pressure to be cleverer beforehand now with the budget cap, because if you do go down the wrong avenue, you've just wasted a load of money that you can't get back. So, and those teams at the top, like Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull, who've had to slim down, they feel that pressure more, obviously, and it's a newer way of working for them too. So that's a really tough situation for Mercedes to be in, I think, when you've got so many changes at once, so many moving parts, so many different ways of working compared to the past, particularly, and then you've got a car that isn't working properly under the new rules. It's a massive story for Formula One, isn't it? And a very, very challenging situation for them to unpick.
Having different people contesting the lead of the championship is also quite good for box office as well, isn't it?
It's very good for box office. And I mean, if there was going to be one team that Liberty would have liked to have seen return to the front line, it was definitely always going to be Ferrari. It's been a fantastic start to the championship. But going back to from the perspective of box office, but going back to your point, on the two extremes of competitive design in Formula One, you've got at one end, you just build a car to the regulations, don't take any risks, you just build a me-too car, and you accept that you're not going to have competitive advantage, but you'll be generally in the right direction. Or the other end, you start taking risks and you start taking calculated risks to gain competitive advantage. And then somewhere in the middle, you have the balance. And the problem for Mercedes, as I see it, is that they've generally been getting it right most of the time for the last 8 years. And the marginal gains thing, so that every increment, like no magic bullet, just lots of little small incremental improvements, is what their culture is as a team. However, periodically they do find a kind of magic bullet. I mean, you could almost say that when the hybrid powertrain regulations came to fruition and everyone saw the way that Mercedes had packaged their engine and split the turbine and the compressor, I mean, that was a game changer. And that was, to some degree, a silver bullet, a magic bullet. They came up with something that was innovative. It was a little bit risky, but they made it work and everyone else was caught napping. And it gave Mercedes and all of their customers a decent competitive advantage at the beginning of the hybrid era. And then Mercedes took that competitive advantage and found ways to sustain that advantage through to what has now been 8 consecutive teams championships. So they've been getting it right most of the time. And I think Toto Wolff and James Allison and the leadership there are generally afraid of ever being complacent. So they generally push in the other direction, which is let's push on and maintain our position of leadership. So this year's car, I mean, I have to say, the moment I saw its designation, W13, they were just asking for trouble, you know, with that. They were just asking for trouble. I mean, 12B, call it something, 13, oh my God, you know, it was, and then it's a high risk strategy. Now, being an optimist, you'd say that if they know that within the data, if they can solve the porpoising problem, the car is going to fly. If they know that that's all they need to do, great. One suspects it's going to be a little bit more complicated. So there have been some unintended consequences of that design which have manifested themselves. And you're right, Ben, you know, they're not a million miles away, but they're nowhere near where they need to be to take the fight to Red Bull and Ferrari. And it's not as though Red Bull and Ferrari are going to be sitting on their hands in terms of development of the car. So they're going to be moving forward. So Mercedes now really are coming from behind, and it's kind of a new territory for them. And as you say, there's been lots of changes within Formula One and within the team. So there's a complexity that they haven't previously had to deal with. But you have to believe that unless they completely lose the plot, you know, Mercedes haven't suddenly forgotten how to do what they do. Toto is a wise guy. He will know, he's a wise man. You know, he'll know But the thing not to do is to knee-jerk in lots of different directions. I need to stay calm, rebuild, take some time over it. And I see the biggest stumbling block being the point that you just raised, Cotters, which is, you know, they're doing all of this within the budget cap. You know, they can't just throw a ton of resource at it. That's just not possible. And if they do try to somehow throw the kitchen sink at it early on in the season, what does that mean later on in the year? And also, what does it mean in terms of the knock-on effect even beyond that? So it's, you know, again, those three sets of regulations that they now have, the sporting, the technical, and the financial, they all, there's an interplay between all of them, and Mercedes have now got a tougher job to do than might have been expected. So it's going to be an intriguing story, certainly over this first third of the season, and then we'll sit down and take stock of where they're at by sort of Monaco time. And I should imagine if they're trailing around some tenths off Ferrari and Red Bull still by that point, it'll start to feel like a proper crisis year for them.
They'll be good at Monaco, won't they? This topsy-turvy season, the tracks where they've historically been rubbish or struggled, they'll be amazing. So Monaco, they'll dominate because the car is working at low speed and doesn't warp us at all, and everywhere else they'll be rubbish.
Meanwhile, their former driver, Valtteri Bottas, has out-qualified both Lewis and George.
Yeah, he's right there, isn't he? I mean, it helps that he's in F1's lightest car, I suppose.
Yeah,
yes. Cars are quite heavy, aren't they?
Well, you've got to be careful, because that was sort of going to be my final point on the technical thing, which is, you know, in terms of overreach, you know, if the Mercedes represents grand scale overreach, all the teams have had difficulties building their cars down to the weight limit, to the extent that the weight limit's been raised a little bit, and there was a story going around the paddock and unverified, but I'll repeat it anyway, because it sounds plausible and it's fairly well sourced, which is that Red Bull's weight-saving drive went as far as removing or modifying the fuel tank to remove a couple of baffles to save, the figure I was quoted was 120 grams. So this is how tight, fine the margins are. They're looking at every part of the car to try and take a little bit off here and there. The risk you take is you take a couple of baffles out, you save your 120 grams, but the new E10 fuel with its different cavitation threshold at the end of a race, it's sloshing around a little bit more with the stuff that's left in the tank. It starts to bubble, it starts to get hot. Then when it goes into the fuel pump assembly, it boils and you get a vapor lock. So that is a plausible explanation for the failure Red Bull experienced in Bahrain. Also explains why Helmut Marko wound his neck in very quickly at the behest of the FIA when he gave quotes to the media suggesting that an FIA sanctioned supplier's part had broken and cost them the Grand Prix. Thither the shepherd's crook appeared from the side of the frame and pulled him off. Begone, fool. It's a game of fine margins. We are coming up to the end of our time slot, and indeed, we're speaking of shepherd's crooks, our managing editor will be wanting to remove us for the our 10 o'clock meeting, which happens at 11 o'clock usually. But before we go, the interesting news, obviously, we were unable to feature it in this issue because of that wretched thing known as an embargo, which is almost as bad as lumbargo, you might say. Formula One has announced a street race in Las Vegas from next year onwards, a Saturday night event, and not on some cruddy little car park outside Caesar's Palace. It will actually be on the strip. It will pass a number of iconic parts of Las Vegas, obviously the Paris, where there's a replica Eiffel Tower, one of the legs of which projects into the gambling hall, a venue where I took Mrs. Codling to see Barry Manilow a few years ago. It also goes past the fountains of the Bellagio, and also the top rated indoor rifle range according to TripAdvisor, where you can even discharge assault weaponry, is not far from the circuit. So whatever pleasure you wish to avail yourself of, Las Vegas has it. What do we think about the forthcoming Las Vegas Grand Prix?
I think the most interesting thing is that Formula One itself is the promoter of the race. And
that's exactly the point I was going to make, Mark. And yeah, I'm really interested to get your view on that as well, because it doesn't seem to be the usual model at all.
No, it's not the usual model, but it tells you everything about Liberty's enthusiasm. They know that they will make it stack up. There's no question it'll be a sellout event. It'll be a spectacular event. It's on a Saturday evening. We can talk about that as well. So there's a number of things about this race which are a major break from the way in which Bernie Eccleston constructed the long-established business model of Formula One: race on a Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock, and a promoter pays a large fee. It's now on a Saturday evening, and there isn't a promoter. Formula One is essentially going to handle the revenue and the profitability for that race itself. And it actually sends a really big warning shot to those Grand Prix who are struggling for fees and struggling to make their economics work, because Formula One are saying, look, there are venues we can go to that we are so confident that we can make a lot of money from. We're actually prepared to, you know, to take the risk on it. The same is not going to be true of some of the other events on the calendar. There's been a lot of chit chat about, is Monaco safe? Is Spa safe? Etc. I do tend
hang on
to,
a second. Isn't that a bit rich when Formula One is the big beast that it is, and it presumably can absorb, you know, that risk much more easily than an individual race promoter? It seems a bit dangerous for Formula One to be competing with its own customers.
Yeah, I don't see it as competing with its own customers. I mean, some of the existing races might take the view, well, why didn't you do that with us? Well, the thing is that it's, you know, different countries, different markets, different levels of confidence. Formula One wanted to have this race, and they particularly wanted to have it in Las Vegas. They want to create a kind of the ultimate entertainment destination event in the United States, and they believe that the three Grand Prix they've got in the United States can equally all survive and thrive. But it's a really major departure, and it tells you a lot about the preparedness of Formula One to look at the future growth of the championship and try some new things and to be innovative in the way they're prepared to do it. But just to finish the point I was going to make, you know, so a lot of people are saying, well, what does this mean for the likes of Spa or Monte Carlo or et cetera? But you then also look at the fact that at precisely this same time, we've seen the return of Zandvoort. We've seen San Marino come back onto the calendar. So there are clearly ways to make it work. And I just think Liberty are sending a sign out there to all the other promoters, you know, where we need to make this championship work commercially. If you're a good partner and you're able to show us your capability to make it work, then, you know, we have a chance of building a long-term future. If, for example, the French Grand Prix are going cap in hand to them saying, oh, actually, we can't afford to renew our contract under the same terms. Could we have a Grand Prix every other year? You immediately put yourself into a weaker position. And Stefano Domenicali has, you know, recently said they have enough they have potentially up to 30 Grand Prix venues. Interesting how many people took that as meaning that he wants to have 30 races. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is we have up to 30 Grand Prix venues, you know, ready to go. That means that he can get to his magic number of 25 quite easily, but they've got a couple of really big targets. The Las Vegas one has now been achieved, and that's only a few months after, and not but just before the very first inaugural Grand Prix in Miami takes place. So, I mean, Miami and now Las Vegas have happened in pretty quick order. Their other big targets, of course, include, for example, having a Grand Prix in Africa. And it'll be interesting to see that come off, because, again, if we're now in an era where Formula One itself is prepared to take a risk on certain events, you know, will Formula One itself promote its own Grand Prix in, for example, Cape Town? The African marketplace will be just a fantastic one for Formula One to get into and to break. And it's an important next step. So I think there's a lot about Las Vegas that's really, really interesting, whether it's going past those fountains or the Bellagio, or whether it's whether the track turns out to be the best track or not. It doesn't actually really matter to Formula One. What they want is to have a successful event commercially, and I've no doubt that they will have it. I've seen a big response from friends of mine who live over on the west coast of America to say, we are so going to Vegas. And indeed, from friends in Europe who have said, well, actually, I've never been to a North American Grand Prix, but my goodness, I'm going to go to Vegas and tack on a holiday. So I think there's no doubt Vegas will be great.
Say no more.
Yeah. So, you know, but what's not to like about, you know, passing a hotel which has a fake volcano that fires on the hour?
Well, one thing,
hopefully not on the cars as they drive past.
When I stayed at the Mirage for a mate got married in the Grand Canyon, the volcano was closed for maintenance and there'll be no eruptions until further notice, said the sign. That is it for another Flat Chat. Visit our website for gpracing.co.uk. Is it gpracing.com?
No, it's not gpracing.com. Come on, Connors. This is not your first rodeo.
You would think so, wouldn't you? gpracing.com for some amazing subscription offers. Before we go, a little bit of unfortunate news, which Ben breaks in his editorial. Unfortunately, we are going to have to raise the cover price by £1 from, is it the May issue onwards, Ben?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the cost of doing stuff has caught up with us. You'll have noticed postage rates have gone up, fuel ridiculous, paper cripplingly expensive. So, all those people passing their costs on to us. So unfortunately, it means we have to come cap in hand to you for a little bit more. So sorry about that. But it is very much the way of the world at the moment. It's very, very annoying. But we will continue. And thank you for listening to our podcast and for reading our magazine. Thank you to my guests. Thank you, Mark Gallagher. Enjoy Melbourne.
Thank you very much. I will. Look forward to reporting back.
And raise a glass of Aussie Red to us. Well, you already have been for the past few months while you've been wintering. Thank you, Ben. I'll see you in 5 minutes for our much delayed meeting, which will no doubt be causing steam to emit from our managing editor's ears.
Yeah, we're in big trouble, aren't we, Sally?
We are in trouble. You're not doing a podcast to join the meeting. Okay, thank you very much. The next edition of Flat Chat, the next edition of GP Racing will be out on Thursday, May the 5th, and there'll be another podcast right around then. Thank you very much.